Hello, everybody. This is George M. Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And it is a real blessing to have with us David Seeloff. And as many of you already know, David is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. He does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And we are working on a series, Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And tonight begins part 8, chapter 8. And this is pretty astonishing stuff. Hi, David.
Hi, George Ann.
Oh, everybody's got a voice thing. today, my a neighbor across the street has come down with this stuff, whatever it is.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I picked up something when I was traveling for a few days, and some of it's, you know, sometimes it's the change in from hot to cold, and sometimes it's sudden dust, and sometimes it's other things. And,
oh, I think a lot of times it's other things.
Yeah, yeah. So, but today we're going to deal with Chapter 8
yes.
of the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world.
Yes.
And this is this chapter is titled Astronomy and the Death of King Herod.
Yes.
And we'll be reading from the words of Dr. Ernest Martin. And so let's get into it. Quoting Dr. Martin, in the face of the historical evidence against it, the majority of theologians have up to now placed the birth of Jesus before the spring of 4 BC. They have insisted on this early date because of a reference in Josephus that King Herod died not long after an eclipse of the moon and before a springtime Passover of the Jews. This eclipse has become an important chronological benchmark in reckoning the year, the exact year of Herod's death. Eclipses are powerful astronomical indicators to show the precise times when events happened in history. Even those that happened 2,000 years ago can be calculated to within a few minutes of their occurrence. And if one can pick the proper lunar eclipse that Josephus referred to, well, then further historical inquiry is considered unnecessary by some because astronomy has settled the chronological issue. Those theologians who adopted this astronomical principle for solving chronological questions are absolutely correct in theory. There is no arguing with eclipses. They are solid and unchallenged witnesses to support the truth of early historical records. But only if the correct eclipse is considered. But when astronomers in the last century told theologians that an eclipse of the moon occurred during the evening of March 13 in 4 BC and that it could be seen in Palestine, or this eclipse is the one that theologians accepted as the one referred to by Josephus. They particularly preferred this eclipse because Josephus said that King Herod died before a springtime Passover. And since March 13, 4 BC was just 1 month before the Passover, they felt in placing all historical events associated with Herod's death and his funeral within that 29-day period. The truth is, however, it is completely illogical to squeeze the events mentioned by Josephus into that short period of time of 29 days. By selecting the wrong eclipse, modern scholars have been forced to tighten considerably the historical events into an abnormally compressed time space of only 29 days. So, eclipse records are very important, but they must be interpreted correctly regarding the chronological period in which they occur. Over a 10-year period, several lunar eclipses are capable of being observed in most areas of the world, and two or three can even occur in 1 year. This relative frequency of lunar eclipses can be a problem in identifying the ones, the particular ones mentioned by the ancient historians, if the early historians gave no details about the time of night, the day of the week, the calendar date on which they happened, or whether the eclipses were full eclipses or partial eclipses. With the eclipse of Josephus, none of these factors is evident. Josephus gave the single clue that a springtime Passover was celebrated not long after the eclipse. This would appear to be a reasonable hint that the eclipse happened sometime in the early or late winter. It is the mention of this Passover that has prompted most his theologians up to now to select the eclipse of March 13, 4 BC, as the one that seems to meet the historical circumstances, but this is not possible. A close examination of the records provided by Josephus unearthed formidable problems in accepting this eclipse. Using common sense plus the application of a general understanding of the Jewish social and religious customs in the first century, all will allow anyone to select the proper eclipse. And in no way can it be the eclipse of March 13, 4 BC. So let's take a look at the lunar eclipses observable from Palestine during the general time for the Nativity of Jesus. From 7 to early 1 BC, there were four lunar eclipses. It is one of these four eclipses to which Josephus has made reference regarding the time of the death of Herod. So let's look at them carefully. There's a table that's in the book, and I can read this without difficulty. The table in the book that I'm reading by Dr. Martin shows when these eclipses happened. And for reference, anyone can look at the book Solar and Lunar Eclipses of the Ancient Near East by M. Kudlek, K-U-D-L-E-K, and E. Mickler, M-I-C-K-L-E-R, in 1971. Or you can go on, I don't have a website for this, but you can actually go on, purchase various star programs and find the lunar eclipses during this period when viewed from Jerusalem, you know, for yourself. The lunar eclipses that were visible in Palestine were, first of all, in 7 BC, there were no eclipses at all visible from Palestine. In 6 BC, there were no eclipses. So in 7 and 6 BC, there were none. In 5 BC, the eclipse occurred on March 23rd. It was a total eclipse. And it occurred at 8:30 p.m., and the elapsed time between the date of the eclipse and the next Passover was 29 days. There was another eclipse in 5 BC, the second one, on September 15th. That was also a total eclipse, but that took place 7 months before the Passover. So, as Josephus said, it occurred near the Passover. Also, in 4 BC, which most theologians consider to be the proper one, but they're in error. In 4 BC, the eclipse occurred on March 13th, and this was a partial eclipse. It occurred, its centrality of the eclipse occurred at 2:20 a.m., and the elapsed time between the eclipse and the next Passover was 29 days later. In 3 BC, there were no eclipses, and in 2 BC, there were no eclipses. But in 1 BC, on January 10th, there was a total eclipse. Its centrality occurred at 1 a.m., and the elapsed time between the eclipse and Passover was 12 and a half weeks. So, which was the eclipse associated with Herod's death? As I've said, and as Dr. Martin has written, most theologians have picked the one that occurred in March 13th, 4 B.C., but they are clearly 3 years too early. They have thrown to the wind the testimonies of the majority of the early fathers of the Christian Church who placed the birth of Jesus from 3 to 1 B.C. If Herod had died in 4 B.C., and Jesus, of course, was born before Herod died, then Jesus would have had to have been born, you know, in 5 B.C. or, you know, earlier, or 6 or 7 B.C., and it just wasn't possible. So they have, you know, if those early church fathers would have been consulted and given a reasonable amount of credibility to question other aspects of this whole situation, which they deserve to be considered credible, then Herod's death would have been sought around the time of 1 B.C., not 3 years earlier, as is commonly done today. We have new historical documentation, quite independent of the early church fathers or independent of Josephus, showing that King Herod died in 1 B.C., and later chapters of this book by Dr. Martin will demonstrate that those historical documents and what new archaeological discoveries indicate to prove the documents. This evidence, along with that given by Josephus, will provide a great deal of evidence to show the eclipse mentioned by Josephus was that of January 10th, 1 B.C. This gives us a veritable key to open the door of understanding for this obscure period of time. When we realize the dark decade of Roman history that we dealt with in an earlier earlier presentation, this dark decade in Roman history from 6 B.C. to 4 A.D., this will also take on a great deal of illumination, and we will be able to fill in events during this confusing period. Confusing historical events, which have been and appear contradictory to historians of the early part of the Roman Empire, will become harmonious and consistent. So much depends on selecting the proper eclipse mentioned by Josephus that it's, you know, mind-boggling. So let's look at the evidence from Josephus, which is the eyewitness account of Nicholas of Damascus, whom Josephus quotes. His records prove that the eclipse of March 13, 4 B.C., which is almost universally accepted, cannot be the correct one. You know, as an aside, Georgianne, it's interesting that almost every single year there's somebody, some astronomer or somebody that comes along that revisits this this discussion of the Star of Bethlehem, but nobody bothers to look at the sources or the information that Dr. Martin provides. They just ignore it. It's just stunning.
Yes.
And, you know, it's like he never existed. And even though it's been in the major publications of the Griffith Observer and discussed, you know, on many TV shows, on even on the big religious shows, when it was first written in earlier editions, you know, Pat Robertson and TBN and other shows, and on numerous radio shows, religious and secular, that everybody just seems to forget about it. You know,
well, there is something wrong with the memory of people in this country. They cannot remember the Clintons in Mena, Arkansas.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah.
Please give me a break. No, there is. They're brain dead. There is something wrong with the American brain.
That's true. Whatever's latest, you know, everything else has been forgotten.
Yeah.
It's really quite stunning.
They know somebody's a crook or a criminal, but they'll vote for him anyway. I mean, oh, please. You know. Oh.
So now we're going to look at the sickness, the death, and then the funeral of King Herod. What the modern historian needs to do, going back to the text of Dr. Martin, what the modern historian needs to do is to catalog the events that occurred from the day of the lunar eclipse until King Herod died, and then add on the time that elapsed for his funeral and his burial, and then count the period from Herod's burial to the springtime Passover, which found Archelaus, the son of Herod, reigning in Jerusalem. The events are well recorded by Josephus. Now, true, Josephus does not give in his writings the exact number of days from the lunar eclipse to the next Passover, but this interval of time can be generally determined without difficulty. Note the sequence of events recorded by Josephus that shows this to be true. The day before the lunar eclipse, two prominent Jewish rabbis were burnt alive at the command of Herod the Great for tearing down a golden eagle which King Herod had erected over the eastern gate of the temple. And Josephus says this was, quote, "and on that very night there was an eclipse of the moon," end quote. And, where are we here? Okay, there we are. And this is to be found in Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 17, number 167. The morning after the eclipse, after that eclipse, Josephus said that Herod's illness became worse. He had been sick for some 2 or 3 months previous, and people began to say that the intensification of King Herod's affliction was the result of the rabbi's death. One has to allow 2 or 3 days after the eclipse for King Herod's physical deterioration to become noticeable. His physicians then tried, as Josephus says, quote, "one remedy after another," end quote. Several remedies to be practiced on King Herod in order to cure him occupied at least 4 or 5 days, a remedy for each day. The elapsed time for these events would reasonably occupy, at a bare minimum, 1 week. These various remedies performed on Herod, however, did not improve his condition. The physicians then recommended that he leave Jericho, where he was at the time, which was then his temporary residence, and retreat to the mineral baths at Calirho. These baths were located on the Dead Sea, about 25 miles southeast of Jericho. Herod heeded their advice, and since he was very ill and getting worse, it would have taken at least a day for him to have been carefully transported to the baths, probably longer. He was either carried on a stretcher or a bed or in a wheeled cart or a wagon of some kind. He then began a period of treatment using the mineral waters from the Dead Sea. The therapy certainly took 2 or 3 days to give the chemicals in the waters a chance to work. But use of the baths gave Herod no sign of improving his condition. He then ordered his attendants to carry him back to Jericho. The elapsed time for these events associated with taking Herod to the baths at Calirho and returning to Jericho would have occupied at least 1 week. The interval would now be 2 weeks away from the eclipse. Once back at his palace in Jericho, Herod devised a monstrous plan. Once he knew his death was not far off, and realizing that most of the Jewish people had a vehement hatred of him, he decided on a scheme that would have the whole nation in mourning at the time of his death. He had many prominent Jewish leaders from all areas of his kingdom assemble at Jericho. Without the elders realizing his intention, ordinarily they probably assumed, well, he's going to announce who his successor is going to be. But Herod's plot was to place them in custody, and then on the day of his death, they were to be executed. In Herod's warped reasoning, this would guarantee that the entire Jewish nation would go into a state of mourning at the time of his death. This heinous plan was put into action. Messengers were sent from Jericho to all parts of King Herod's realm, bearing orders for the elders of the cities and the villages to appear at Jericho on pain of death for their refusal. Of course, they were going to be killed if they obeyed, but nonetheless, they were to be killed if they refused to come. Since the northern cities of Herod's kingdom were at least 130 miles away, a period of 3 days for the couriers to reach the elders has to be considered, a day or so for them to prepare for the trip, and then 3 or 4 days for the elders, because they were elders, to reach Jericho would occupy in total, at the very least, a week's time. Josephus said that these municipal elders, with other Jewish dignitaries, finally arrived at Jericho and were locked up in the Hippodrome. This is the racetrack area in Jericho. The elapsed time for this assemblage of elders was at the very least 1 week, so that the interval of time now comes to 3 weeks after the eclipse. Josephus said, after this, that letters came from Augustus in Rome giving Herod permission to kill Herod's son Antipater. The king had him executed immediately, and Herod died 5 days later. And this is all of these are sourced by Dr. Martin from Josephus. Herod's survivors then determined that the elders imprisoned in the Hippodrome were not to be killed, in spite of King Herod's orders. The elders were released, and many were allowed to return home. The elapsed time for these events would reasonably occupy 5 to 7 days, in other words, almost 4 weeks after the eclipse. So now we come to the funeral of King Herod. Josephus said that Herod ordered his funeral to be the grandest display, the grandest funeral ever bestowed on a king. The preparations for such a funeral would have taken some time. Josephus shows that the arrangements for the official procession were begun only after King Herod died. In no way was it possible for a royal funeral to be arranged in a single day. Indeed, several days would have been needed before the procession from Jericho toward Jerusalem could commence. The final burial place of King Herod was to be at the Herodion, which itself is about 8 miles south of Jerusalem. It surely took a few days to prepare for the procession in order for it to proceed. Everybody has to get in line, big parades take a while. Well, that's what this was, a procession. These few days must have been the case because we are told that all the royal ornaments were brought to Jericho from Jerusalem and from Masada and other places wherever they were kept for the procession. The crown jewels, in other words, and other regalia would have to be kept under guard in the palace in Jerusalem, and it surely would have taken 2 or 3 days to go get them and then bring them back. Even the abundance of spices to treat the body along the way, in other words, to keep it from smelling or to overwhelm the smell, because Herod's body was not entombed, or embalmed, at least not a great deal that we know of. Even the abundance of spices to treat the body along the way and at the tomb, as it mentions in reference to Christ in Luke 23:56 and Luke 24:1, which required, as Josephus says, 500 domestic servants of King Herod to carry. So it no doubt took quite some time to collect and prepare all that material. To keep the body in reasonable condition until the funeral and burial ceremony, until the funeral and the burial ceremonies were over, the body had to be prepared in a way to prevent putrefaction. Josephus showed that those having royal dignity were to be embalmed. And in Palestine, this was done with honey. And this is in Josephus Wars of the Jews, Book 1, Number 184. For the time it took the funeral procession to journey from Jericho to Jerusalem, and then the Herodian, King Herod's body had to be prepared to prevent the senses of those, the olfactory senses of those attending the funeral solemnities, to suffer the consequences of being near an unburied and an unembalmed corpse. King Herod's body, however, was properly embalmed for the trip to the Herodian. Placing the body in honey was one way to prevent putrefaction. And the 500 domestics carrying spices also had their duties assigned to preserve a proper dignity for the king. All of this took time to accomplish, but there were other reasons why the funeral cortege could not have started on the day following King Herod's death. Josephus said that the, quote, whole army, end quote, the entire army, was represented in the procession. For military commanders of the armed forces located throughout the realm to be summoned to Jericho and given time to arrive in itself would have taken several days. And remember, this was a police state at that time, so there were a lot of military King Herod had. And that's why the Romans liked him, because he kept such a tight lid on a very disruptive Jewish territory. This, for military commanders of the armed forces located throughout the realm to be summoned to Jericho and given time to arrive, would have taken several days, at least a week, and probably longer. There were few prearrangements for a massive funeral procession that Josephus said took place, since Herod at first believed he would find a cure for his sickness while he was at his winter home in Jericho. But elite units of the army were not the only ones summoned to Jericho for the procession. It would also have taken some time for the relatives of Herod and other political and religious leaders of the realm, as well as representatives and nobility from neighboring nations, to arrive for the procession. These military commanders and other political luminaries gathering at Jericho would have taken a week or so. So we're now 5 weeks away after the eclipse. Once all the official dignitaries were assembled for the procession, the funeral cortege could then move toward the Herodian in stages. Notice what Josephus said, quoting the eyewitness account of Nicholas of Damascus. Quote, the body was carried on a golden bier, embroidered with very precious stones of great variety, and it was covered over with purple, as was the body itself. He had a diadem on his head, and above it a crown of gold. He had also a scepter in his right hand. About the bier were his sons and his numerous relations. Next to these, the soldiers, distinguished according to their several countries and denominations. And they were put in the following order. First of all went his guards, then the band of Thracians, after them the Germans, next the band of Galatians, and everyone in their habiliments of war. In other words, they carried all their weapons with them. And behind these marched the whole army in the same manner as they used to go out to war, and as they used to be put in array for their muster by their muster masters and centurions. These were followed by 500 of his domestics carrying spices, end quote, according to Josephus in Antiquities, Book 1, number 198. Nothing of such grandeur was given to the funerals of ordinary people. They were usually buried within a day, and that was the end of the matter. But with kings, it was different. An elaborate procession was designed by Archelaus at the behest of Herod himself for the grandest funeral that any man had ever had, and it was majestic indeed. The procession set out toward Jerusalem from Jericho, and the Herodian in stately style. The mourners went 8 stades, which is exactly 1 Roman mile, toward the Herodian, according to Josephus. Now, Plutarch, in his account of Gaius Gracchus, tells us how 8 stades was the distance selected to be reckoned as one, tells us how 8 stades was the distance selected to be reckoned as 1 Roman mile on the imperial highways. And this is mentioned in Langhorne, page 582. The distance of 8 stades became a standard, that all followed in judging distance on the Roman roads. So Josephus tells us that while all of the military personnel in their funeral procession were fully dressed to war, they did not rush to the burial site. They walked in a slow funereal cadence in a military style called an 8 stades march at single mile intervals per day. This type of mourning march was very slow. The army marched 1 mile a day. Normally, the Roman army marched 20, and then when they were pushed, they could do 30 or even occasionally 40 miles a day. But in this funeral procession, they marched 1 mile a day. Many scholars recognize this fact. For example, Professor Wickgren at the University of Chicago, who helped translate Josephus for the Loeb edition, relates this as the correct meaning of Josephus, and he certainly is correct. Josephus, who himself had been a military man, simply stated that the military cadence was in the 8 stades mode of military march, a solemn, mournful funeral march. In my opinion, very likely they pretty much almost did heel to toe, because that would be a very slow type of march, and yet you would still cover ground and still reach the mile a day. And a mile is not a lot.
Yeah.
Remember, everybody walked in those days.
Yes.
Indeed, since Herod planned his own funeral ceremonies, and since the Jews were accustomed to a 30-day mourning time called a Shaloshim, Herod simply ordered that the procession to Jerusalem for a brief lying in state, and then to the Herodian for burial, would occupy the whole of that required 30-day mourning period. It had to be a slow journey for other reasons. Since it was customary for the funeral biers in royal funeral processions to be carried on the shoulders of the king's relatives or by important state officials, the journey took a considerable amount of time. Transporting the bier by a wheeled vehicle was out of the question. Even good roads at the time were normally paved with cobblestone, and ordinary ones were simple dirt tracks with uneven pavements. With the axles of ancient wagons bolted solidly to their frames and not having the convenience of springs to soften the jolts, transporting the king by wagon would have shaken the body into quite an unceremonial condition. This would have jeopardized even the preservation of the delicately embalmed state of the body. Come to think of it, Georgianne, imagine how heavy a coffin full of honey would be in addition to the body.
Yeah.
To prevent such an undignified condition, it was essential for the close relatives and state officials to carry the bier. The bier is the coffin structure, coffin-like structure. It was customary to place horizontal poles at convenient locations under the coffin, and then to place those supports on the shoulders of the pallbearers. With this being the case, the procession was only able to proceed to the Herodian in military 8 stades fashion, a Roman mile per day. There was another reason for this. Funerals were accounted as sacred ceremonies, which were conducted in accordance to strict religious laws. they were holy occasions, and people had to act accordingly. Both Moses and Joshua were told to take off their shoes because they were standing on holy ground. This is in Exodus 3, verse 5, and Joshua 5, verse 15. And in funeral ceremonies, it was demanded that people in the procession go barefoot. This is in Ezekiel 24, verse 17, and see also 2 Samuel 15, verse 30, and Jeremiah 13, verse 22. Going unshod at such times was a general custom adopted by most ancient nations, as well as the Jews. The excellent work, the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, has the following account to show this prevailing custom among the various peoples of the world at this time in history. Quote, "The women in the procession through the town mourning Demeter went unshod, and so did the Locarian virgins in approaching the altar of Athene. In drought, a procession and religion and ritual was intended to propitiate the gods by this token of humiliation and sorrow. Many other instances of this are known. In actual mourning, mourning rites, going barefoot was used by both Greeks and Romans. For example, Suetonius describes how the young nobles who removed the ashes of Augustus from the pyre were barefoot. Bion describes Aphrodite wailing for Adonis as barefoot, and Otono was unshod at the death of Actaeon. It was also a token of distraction, as when the Roman Vestals fled from Rome with sacred utensils." Now, here's an emphasized point. Among the Hebrews, to go barefoot was also a sign of mourning, end quote. And this is the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, Book 11, on page 475. With people in the stately procession having to go barefoot for 25 miles, which is the distance from Jericho to Jerusalem, or perhaps to the Herodian, all the way to the Herodian, it can easily be understood why they proceeded by stages about a mile a day to the Herodian. This has to be the case because the barefoot carriers of the bear, being relatives of Herod or dignitaries of the realm, were not accustomed to going barefoot. With their tender feet, they could not have gone much further in a day, carrying the heavy weight of the bear. This would mean that the funeral procession from Jericho to the Herodian lasted about 25 days. But this does not take into account a period of lying in state at the capital of the nation in Jerusalem. Such a ceremonial procedure was normal for kings and high government officials. The Romans usually had their dignitaries lie in state for 7 days. Herod would have had a similar period, or nearly so, at his capital city of Jerusalem. It would have been entirely out of character to have denied the king such recognition. Some people, on the other hand, have thought that Josephus meant only that the army went a mile from Jericho with the cortege, and then they dispersed to their areas of duty throughout the realm. And this was suggested by Douglas Johnson in the book Chronos, Kairos, and Christos. But in no way could this be the meaning of Josephus. Such a departure of the army would have left the expensive royal items in jeopardy of seizure. Without the army, the Jewish people, who despised King Herod with extreme passion, could well have heaped abuse on the corpse and stripped the bear of all its treasures and honor. Even the life of the new king, Archelaus, who accompanied the body of his father to its destination, could well have been placed in jeopardy. Indeed, it's really inconceivable that the royal troops and servants did not attend the procession all the way to the Herodian. Such a thing would have been entirely out of character with the funeral of any king, let alone with the immense egotism of King Herod. And remember, Josephus said it was Herod himself who planned the entire funeral ceremonies. He didn't allow any preparations to be made, but he had a plan of what was to be done, first, second, and third. We can rest assured that it was no fly-by-night affair. There's one thing that King Herod did do well, and that was that he planned things. It was planned, like most things that Herod did, to be grand and impressive. This is why it was necessary for the army, in stately and regimental style, and also ready for combat, to accompany the bier of the king from Jericho to the capital at Jerusalem, rest in state in Jerusalem, and then to transport it to the final resting place at the Herodian, 8 miles south of Jerusalem. Everything must have been done with complete grandeur and majesty. To give stateliness to the procession, Josephus shows it journeyed from Jericho by stages, proceeding about a mile a day in the direction of the Herodian, which was about 25 miles away. Let me get a drink of water here. This means the procession would have lasted about 4 weeks, because the cortege could not have traveled on the 3 Sabbath days. If the king, however, lay in state in the vicinity of Jerusalem for a period of time, additional days would have to be given to the interval. Since to reach the Herodian from Jericho in this fashion took at least 4 weeks, which was designed by Herod to occupy the whole the entire of the period for the 30-day required mourning period, known as the Shaloshim, then Herod was buried 8 weeks away. We better break here. Now, I'm going to repeat the last sentence. Since to reach the Herodian from Jericho in this fashion took at least 4 weeks, as it was designed by Herod, to occupy the whole of the 30-day period required for mourning, known as the Shaloshim, then Herod was buried 8 weeks away from the eclipse, if we allow the bare minimum of time for these things to have been accomplished. We're already past the 29 days from the 4 BC eclipse. So, going on. For royal funeral processions to proceed by stages, with each stage being a daily stopping of the procession, and of course, you had to set up camp each time. It's well attested for this period. After King Herod's benefactor, the Emperor Augustus, died at Nola in southern Italy, his body was conveyed over the 120 miles to Rome by stages. And this is in Suetonius Augustus, page 100. Starting from Nola, senators from the various communities along the route carried the body of Augustus by night from one town to the next, until it reached the outskirts of Rome. During the day, the bier of Augustus' body rested in the town hall or principal temple of each halting place. When the body reached Bavilla, just outside of Rome, knights of the empire then conveyed the body of the dead emperor to Palatine Hill inside the city. From there, the final part of the procession began. The body was taken to the forum, where it lay in state. As mentioned before, lying in state for Roman leaders was usually 7 days. And this is mentioned by Toynbee, Arnold Toynbee's Death and Burial in the Roman World, page 45. And then, with great solemnity, the body was carried to the Campus Martius for cremation. The ashes were finally taken to the Augustan Mausoleum in the north of the city. This terminated the procession. A funerary feast was then held, and a 9-day mourning period began. The whole funeral period for Augustus lasted from the 19th of August to the 11th or 12th of September. This means that the solemnities lasted just over 3 weeks. The funeral of Herod would no doubt have had a solemnity certainly equal to Augustus, and it was probably even more grand. Herod had an excessive feeling of personal worth and ego, and he ordered his funeral to be, quote, most splendid, as Josephus says. It had to be, quote, a majestic funeral such as no other king ever had, end quote. And we're told by Archelaus that Herod did indeed obtain his wishes. And with royal Jewish funerals, the official time of mourning for the general public was 30 days, called a Shaloshim. And this was followed by a further 7 days mourning period for the family of Herod. While the Roman period of mourning, time for mourning, was only 9 days, with Augustus' procession and funeral rites taking just over 3 weeks, Herod's funeral ceremonies lasted much longer to accord with the biblical and Jewish mourning customs. Now, one thing for certain, royal funerals took time to accomplish. This is the case even today. Witness the funeral ceremonies a few years back from when Dr. Martin wrote his last edition, associated with the preparations and ceremonies associated with Emperor Hirohito of Japan. It took about a month and a half for all the funeral protocol, religious and secular, to be accomplished. Hirohito's funeral rites, occupied slightly more time to celebrate than even those of King Herod, and they were about twice as long as those of Augustus. Recall that it took a lot of time for heads of state and other dignitaries from around the world to attend the final funeral ceremonies of Hirohito. Something similar to this would have taken place with the funeral of Herod. When King Herod's younger brother, Pheroras, died, Herod himself, quote, prepared him for burial and brought him to Jerusalem, where he provided a burial place and ordered a solemn mourning for him, unquote. And later, when Herod's son Philip died, quote, his body was carried to the tomb that he himself had built before he died, and there was a costly funeral. And all the, end quote. All of these are from Josephus, listed in Dr. Martin's book. These ancient solemnities are not practiced in modern Jewish customs today. The funeral and mourning services of Prime Minister Rabin, who was assassinated, occupied only 7 days, but ancient funerals were much longer. So let's look at the important mourning periods which accompanied King Herod's funeral rites. These necessary religious ceremonies show that just over a 4-week period elapsed from the death of Herod until he was finally buried at the Herodium. Note the periods of public and private mourning. This point is a very significant factor in determining the interval of time between Herod's death and his burial. The fact is, there were two types of mourning periods that were accomplished at the death of a king or someone who was of national prestige. As mentioned before, the first was a public mourning period of 30 days begun immediately after the death of an important person. This is in Numbers 20, verse 29, and Deuteronomy 34, verse 8. There was a further 7-day mourning period for the close relatives, which took place after the burial. This is in Numbers 19, verse 14. It was possible for separate public and private mourning periods among the Jews to overlap one another, either completely or partially, depending on when the burial itself took place. But it is highly unlikely that they overlapped in King Herod's case. There is such an example in the Bible itself of the various ceremonies associated with the death of a prominent person. We need to look at the mourning periods involved in the wake of this person's death, and also the procession that accompanied the person to his final resting place. The biblical example is that of Jacob, the father of Joseph. Immediately after the death of Jacob in Egypt, the Egyptian embalmers took their normal 40-day period to prepare the body. It was the custom in ancient Egypt for people to mourn during the period for embalming the body. Then there followed a 30-day mourning period, which became the common custom among Israelites. This was known as the Shaloshim, 30 days, which became the official mourning period for all people honoring any dignitary. Then Joseph arranged a magnificent procession of all top people in Egypt and Israel, the people in Egypt and the people of Israel, with, quote, chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company, end quote. Genesis 50, verse 9. Jacob's regal procession went all the way to the border of Palestine. Then was accomplished a further 7 days of mourning, according to Genesis 50, verse 10. And thus, in this example, which Herod would have been well aware of and would have wanted to emulate, the Shaloshim occurred after the embalming was completed, and the 7 days occurred after Jacob's burial, and they were separate periods of mourning that did not overlap. A similar situation must have occurred with Herod's procession to Jerusalem and to the Herodian with its funerary ceremonies. While the public mourning period for the Romans was normally only 9 days, the Jews were subjected to an extended period of time. From the time of Jacob onward, public mourning lasted 30 days. As I have shown, that 30-day mourning period was known as a Shaloshim. It was common for all dignitaries in Israel to be honored with such a period of mourning that began at the time of their deaths. Moses and Aaron were formally honored by such a Shaloshim. And Josephus informs us that Miriam, Moses and Aaron's sister, were similarly mourned. Interestingly, there is absolute historical information that such a public mourning period for national figures was commonly practiced by the Jews in the first century. When the Jews in Jerusalem erroneously heard that Josephus had been killed in the line of duty, and he was then the commander of Jewish forces in Galilee at the beginning of the war with the Romans in 67 AD, the people of Jerusalem immediately went into a period of public mourning for 30 days, the Shaloshim. If a military commander of such as Josephus was given a Shaloshim at the announcement of his death, we can be utterly assured that King Herod was given a similar Shaloshim by his son Archelaus and the people of Judea when his death was announced. Indeed, Josephus informs us that there was a public mourning conducted throughout the realm and that the people of Judea showed an honorable respect for the whole of the funeral ceremonies for the dead king. This is a very important indication regarding our question of the interval of time between King Herod's death and the end of the public mourning, which happened near the time of King Herod's burial at the Herodian. This fact standing alone shows that there had to be just over 4 weeks between Herod's death and his burial, and this dovetails remarkably with the 28 to 30 days or so, traveling about a mile a day, for the funeral procession to reach the Herodian from Jericho. But there is even more. Once King Herod was buried, then Archelaus and the immediate family had to undergo their further 7 days of private mourning period. After those 7 days, a funeral feast was then ordered by Archelaus for the people of Jerusalem. This would mean that the public mourning period, the Shloshim, and also Archelaus' private mourning period, as well as the funeral feast, would have been concluded at the bare minimum about 9 weeks after the eclipse of the moon, and probably a little longer. So now we come to the Passover of the Jews. Josephus records that other things took place in Jerusalem before the springtime Passover occurred that year. After both mourning periods and the funeral feast were over, Archelaus then assumed his normal activities as the new king of Judea. He gave audience to the people as a king. He made changes in the duties of army personnel, and he conferred promotions on numerous officers. He also took time to liberate many prisoners confined by his father and publicly heard and made decisions on a number of lawsuits occurring in the courts. The hearing and judging of several lawsuits certainly took a few days to accomplish. Josephus, or rather Nicholas of Damascus, whom Josephus was quoting, said Archelaus did these officials' duties and, quote, and many other things, end quote, between the time when all of the public and private mourning periods and the funeral feast were completed and when the beginning of the Passover season took place. Sheer reason would have to allow a minimum of 1 week for all of these official duties of Archelaus to have taken place when he resumed his normal executive activities. After Archelaus and the general population met all these requirements, then came the Passover period. Now for an important point. Because it is clear that Archelaus resumed his normal duties as king before the start of the Passover season, this proves conclusively that both the Shloshim, the 30-day mourning period, and the personal and private mourning period of 7 days were fully completed before Passover. This is important because some people have imagined that the mourning periods for the dead ceased if the Passover season came on the calendar before the mourning periods were fulfilled. Now, this is true, but in this case, we find from the records of Josephus himself that the mourning periods, both of them, were entirely fulfilled before the Passover that year commenced. This is proof positive that there were at least 5 weeks of time between King Herod's death and the start of Passover in the year that Herod died. If one were conservative in estimating the interval of time between the lunar eclipse, which occurred just after the two rabbis were executed, and the arrival of the springtime Passover, one has to allow, at a bare minimum, 10 weeks. But to be reasonable, one has to admit that a few days more would make the historical scenario fit even better. It would allow for a more comfortable timetable. The interval of time was probably near 12 weeks. So, now we come to the importance of this information. The above historical events can easily be seen in the records of Josephus, and importantly, they allow us to determine the exact eclipse of the moon that Josephus was referring to. It will also help us to eliminate, in a decided way, the principal eclipse that most all theologians have erroneously accepted as the one intended by Josephus. For the past 200 years, it has been common for theologians to accept the partial lunar eclipse on the night of March 13, 4 BC, as the one referred to by Josephus. But they are wrong, since lunar eclipses can only occur at full moon. The interval of time from the full moon day of March 13, 4 BC, to the beginning of Passover at 4 BC, which is the next full moon day, is a period of only 29 days on the Jewish calendar. In no way, shape, or form can all the many events associated with King Herod's death and funeral, as recorded by Josephus, be squeezed into that short 29-day period. This major difficulty in accepting the March 13 eclipse has been noted by the Roman historian Timothy Barnes in his article in the Journal of Theological Studies, volume 19, 1968, page 209. To alleviate the problem, some scholars have suggested that the Passover to which Josephus referred was that of the next year, 3 BC, but the Passover a year hence is far too remote for consideration. Among other things, Josephus said the people at that following Passover were still mourning for the two rabbis that Herod killed on the eve of the eclipse. This could hardly have been the case some 13 months later. Also, Josephus shows that the new king, Archelaus, went to Rome after that Passover, and that he was, quote, in haste to depart, end quote, according to Antiquities 17, 218 to 219. In order, Archelaus rushed to Rome after the Passover in order to confirm his kingship with the Roman emperor. In other words, Archelaus was not king until the Roman emperor said he was. Archelaus would not have delayed his trip an entire year. And also, Sabinus, Caesar's financial officer for Syrian affairs, met Archelaus at the port city of Caesarea as Sabinus was going to Jerusalem. Sabinus had just arrived from Rome in order to secure to the imperial treasury the effects of the dead King Herod. Josephus said that Sabinus was going, quote, with haste. It is inconceivable. In no conceivable way can one imagine that Sabinus waited 13 months to take charge of King Herod's property. All of these events prove that the Passover after the eclipse of Josephus was the very next Passover and not 1 year away. They also prove that the eclipse of March 13, 4 BC, cannot be the one mentioned by Josephus because it is impossible to compress those historical and ritualistic requirements into a period of 29 days. Now, in the next chapter, I will, Dr. Martin writes, give further information that will show the only eclipse that could possibly fit the historical scenario that Josephus recorded from the eyewitness accounts of Nicholas of Damascus, whom he quoted, was the one of January 10th, 1 BC. As a matter of fact, we do not need exact chronological dates given in the text Josephus to determine the date of King Herod's death. The historical context in which that lunar eclipse was mentioned is sufficient enough to give us the precise period for the death of Herod. It occurred somewhere between the eclipse of January 10, 1 BC, and the following springtime Passover. When this fact is recognized by historians today, even that dark decade over which classical historians lament in regard to the fragmentary history of the early Empire of Rome will be greatly illuminated and made clear. Astronomy is the key to it all, and it's time to pay attention to it. And so ends Chapter 8, Astronomy and the Death of King Herod.
Wow. You know, this is... You made a really important statement there, David. Astronomy is very important. And, you know, the average school today, they don't teach anything about the heavens.
Right.
Astronomy. You know, I mean, the kids that graduate are lucky if they can read and write.
Right, and what you and I took in high school and college is a great deal outdated, although the planetary times and the cycles and all this other stuff, that still applies. But it's amazing what has been discovered since the time we went to school. None of that, none of those changes affect what is in this straightforward history that Dr. Martin has written. You know, this is just straight historical facts and logic, and mostly facts with logic explaining the facts. And it's really straight. It's what I call good history. I mean, you can follow the argument and you can follow the evidence and why this isn't more widely accepted. It's very straightforward, and there is no way out of it.
Yeah.
It's just, this is, you know, there are certain things that had to be done, and there's, you know, you've got some benchmarks. There was an eclipse. There was the murder of the two rabbis. There was the eclipse, and then there was the Passover. Well, like Dr. Martin said, both eclipses always occur during a full moon, and so does the Passover. So you've got a situation that, you know, which eclipse was it? Well, it must have been, you know, much earlier eclipse than just the 29 days. One full moon sequence must have been more than just the single full moon sequence. One cycle, rather.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And I think that in the very near future, astronomy is going to become a lot more important to the common person than it's ever been, you know, because of the times we're coming into.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether ASK and the Byte Show will be used to get this information out to the world. All it takes is, you know, one person to help us promote this information, or two people at God's will, and, you know, because, you know, we don't have the resources. We're just doing what we can.
Yeah.
You're putting it out to the world, and, you know, one person at a time, and that's fine. I'm content with that, as you are. More the merrier.
Yeah.
The more people we reach, the better. But it appears, as it's always been, in New Testament times and now, there's not going to be a big media blitz. However, once God acts in world events so that it's obvious that, A, he exists and he's interested, there's not going to be a lot of deists running around after he's done.
Right.
And, of course, a deist says, well, God exists, but he just set things up and let the clock work through.
Yeah.
once he starts taking visible action, he's obviously working behind the scenes and in the lives of individuals and through his Holy Spirit in the lives of the Ecclesia.
Yes.
But he's going to begin acting so that everybody will know, A, that God exists, B, that he's active in world events, and, you know, there's going to be an accounting.
Oh, boy.
And then
that
information will get out and spread around the world, and people will generally accept it. And that is what people will rebel from. They will rebel from God. They will not rebel from evangelical Christianity or from Hinduism, and that's not what the falling away is. The falling away is from a general knowledge and acceptance, and even a partial repentance on a superficial level, as so many people have done. And then there will be a falling away and a return to the old ways and a resentment against God, as there is against much of authority, whether parental or governmental, in many cases. You know, this is just the way mankind is created, and this is the system that God has set up, And eventually, believe it or not, this whole system will result in God's glory. And it almost seems impossible, but luckily we have the Word of God to tell us that things will work out for good and for the good of each individual, as well as nations, as well as all mankind. So,
well, it's certainly it's fascinating, it's interesting,
yeah.
And, you know,
world history revolves around Christ.
Yes, it does.
He's the fulcrum. He's the centrality of it, from before his appearance on earth to the conclusion of the aeons, you might say. He is the central event of all history. And that's what we're covering here, is his birth and incarnation and when he was enfleshed, so to speak. Emmanuel, God with us. So, you know, this is important material. As dull as it is to some people who don't like history, I'm a history geek, so I love
me
this
too.
Stuff. But,
you don't know history, David. You don't know anything.
Yeah, you don't know history, you don't know nothing.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
If you don't know where you've been, you cannot know where you're going.
Right, right.
You know?
And by history, we're also including geography and,
yes.
You know, those other things. Chronology, to a certain extent.
Yeah.
It's important. In general, it's not that important to know what happened exactly when. You know, I had classes where we had to cite dates and everything. But there was a purpose for that, and it's so that you could recognize benchmarks in relation to other events. Because something that would happen in one part of the Eastern Roman Empire had an effect in the western part, for example. You know, when the Mediterranean shut down as a Roman lake, so to speak, the empire collapsed. There was no more Roman Empire. The Roman Empire shut down when the Eastern Roman Empire lost control of the Mediterranean. That's when they lost their power. There were other factors involved, of course. Population decline and famines and plagues and weird weather and stuff. But once they lost the trade in between north and south of the Mediterranean coasts, as well as the eastern part of the Mediterranean trading with the western part, that's when everything fell apart. That's when civilization started to collapse.
Yes.
And, you know, what's important to know in history is the sequence of events, which is pretty much what Dr. Martin covered in this Chapter 8, is, you know, what had to happen first, second, third in a funeral. And that's what's important in history. You can always look up the dates pretty much once you get out of class, but you have to know what happens first, second, and third, and what's the sequence of events. That's what makes important. That's what's important in history. And you have to know that the Greeks came before the Romans. If you don't know that, you don't, you know, it's going to be very difficult to understand what goes on when.
Oh,
the dates are, don't mean anything. So,
and geography. I mean,
and geography. Yeah.
You remember the book, The Little Prince?
Yeah.
Where he says, you know, that it's really handy to know the shape of China and where it is in case you crash land there in the night and you don't know how to get out of China because you don't know what borders it. I mean, it was. Oh my goodness, how true. You know.
Yeah.
I mean. When I was in grammar school, we had a beautiful globe of the world. There were maps of the world in the school. Everybody learned about geography.
At the University of Wisconsin in the library, they had a 5-foot globe.
Oh, my goodness.
5-foot diameter. It was fun because your whole perspective of things changes.
Yes.
It really does. a large, large globe is totally different than a map or a small globe. You just have a better, I don't know, I just loved it. But it was, I'd go there just to look at, you know, this country in relation to this country, and you know, Napoleon going to Russia and what he had to try to do and fail, and Hitler and that sort of thing. And the Crusades and the Middle East and the rise of Islam. You know, the distances involved on a on a large globe have a different perspective than when you're dealing with a small globe or a map or on a two-dimensional structure. And, you know, a globe itself is just a representation, a pale representation of things. But nowadays, you know, I could not go to a map and, you know, how you used to get blank maps in school where you had to name the states or something.
Right, right. Right.
I could not do all the countries in Africa or in southeastern Europe.
Heck, they changed their names.
Sure, sure. Or the countries that broke away from Russia, from the Soviet Union. I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And neither could any of the candidates or the probably most people in the State Department couldn't do it unless they're in the area,
yeah,
you know, working there.
They smoke a lot of funny stuff at the State Department. you know, I bought a map, you know, like a AAA road map.
Right.
You know, in the grocery store, sometimes they sell those maps. Oh, it was $3, and I bought one. When I got it home and I opened it up, David, the outlines between the states in the United States are so faint, you cannot hardly distinguish one state from another. Yeah, New World Order. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I've, let's see, on the Ask website, and this is something you might want to put on your website, is the link to the CIA things. Let's see, it's pretty, oh, where is it? Here it is. CIA.gov, and then you can go to the fact book. It's the CIA World Factbook. They keep it up to date constantly. It has facts and figures and maps of the world and of regions, and each country has a map. And then you can see the surrounding nations. It's really an excellent, excellent resource. And I recommend that, as well as the BBC country profiles.
Yes.
And The Economist also has some. And have some, you know, there are some wonderful resources on the Internet that, frankly, I use regularly. And not only that, but the CIA material is all free and copyright free. So I use the maps and change them and do all sorts of things with them occasionally. They're very, very useful for me because it's excellent to visualize through a map sometimes what you're dealing with in present day, you know, when you're talking about present day countries.
Right.
For example, the breakup of the growth of Egypt, which was the article last month, or the Iran, or, you know, Iraq, or the breakup of the future breakup of Lebanon into a north and a south, as Psalm 83 seems to indicate. When that will happen, I have no idea, but before the end time, certainly. So, you know, all this material is useful to keep perspectives as to what is going on here. Because God determines the borders of the nations according to Acts 17. I think it's verse 34 or 38, something like that. And when he wants a change, because you've been to San Diego, right? And gone to Tijuana?
Yes.
It's the same, it's the same piece of land. You know, the structure of the land isn't different from Tijuana to San Diego, and neither is the weather. And, you know, so what makes the difference? It's an artificial border, and yet that artificial thing has meaning. And God literally determines that. There's no doubt. He sets the boundaries of peoples. And these things are, you know, the boundaries of King Herod's kingdom changed after he died. Archelaus was maintained as king for just a short period of time. And then the Romans brought in started bringing in the governors, which, you know, the one time, at the time of Christ was king, was Governor Pilate. And God determines all these things. Even though men, you know, man proposes and God disposes.
Yeah. I wish the good Lord would get busy and start disposing of a few things. Anyway, God bless you, David, for all of the,
thanks, Georgia,
the work that you're doing. And I hope people will continue to support the Bite Show.
Absolutely, the Bite Show. Yeah, absolutely. Keep the stuff getting out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, patronize the materials and the sponsor.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, buy Dr. Martin's book if this interests
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Of all kinds, and all the different books that he wrote. He, you know, he has a complete section on most of the basic topics of Christianity, you know, the structure of the Bible and how it was developed, the birth of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ, as well as the location of the temple, the rise of, you know, a book on the Star of Bethlehem that we're covering and the birth of Christ, as well as the rise of heterodox and unorthodox Christianity, heretical Christianity, much of which we have around us today.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, there's a lot of information there on in the Ask website and on the Bite Show.
And, you know, like the series that we're doing here, you have the book online that
right.
people can read for free.
Right, and yeah. follow along with the shows that we're doing here.
Yes.
And, you know, are you doing something similar where people are reading their work online, or do they just, you know, talk on certain topics and stuff?
It varies. It varies, David. One to another, you know.
No, I wish I had time to listen to everything. Doing my own work. So, well, thank you, Georgianne.
Well, God bless you and all the listeners out there. Go to askelm.com. That's askelm.com. And we'll be back very soon with David Seeloff. So God bless you all. And good night, everybody.